So, welcome to the first ever What Am I Missing podcast. My name is Andy, and we also have...
Ben McCormack here, alongside.
So we had this idea for a podcast, and we thought it would be fun for us, firstly, but also, you know, possibly entertaining, because we worked together, or we used to work together, and we had some pretty interesting conversations about games and anime and movies, and Ben had the idea of, you know what, let's let everyone else judge us on this.
Terrible mistake, really.
Well, each week we're going to talk about something that one of us is really, really into, and the other one is kind of clueless about, and talk about why we should be into it. What are we missing? That's where the title came from. What am I missing? So this week's topic is Final Fantasy VII.
Yes.
Yes. It would be fair to say it's the most popular RPG of all time.
It's certainly up there. And it really, its impact is so huge that we still talk about it today.
Right.
In so many lists, it pops up. Mm. Its influence brought so many people into the PlayStation 1 particularly. And I never really played it.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I think I agree. It's definitely up there. I mean, obviously now, you know, you kind of saw a resurgence of the Western RPG, right? With Skyrim and Fallout, and they kind of made a huge comeback. So it's probably not on as many people's radars as before, but with the remake coming...
No, man, you saw the reaction of that E3. People still love that game.
Yeah, I guess.
And particularly after, there was the whole 13 problems, shall we say, and 12's many issues.
I think you're being very charitable, referring to the 13 problem in air quotes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think people were just excited, people still held on to that as the high mantle for such a beloved franchise.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's true. It is definitely, you know, if you, any Final Fantasy fan you meet, I mean, the chances that 7 is their favorite one are immediately really high, you know.
Yeah.
Which is where I'm kind of an outlier, because I like 7 a lot, and I'm hoping I can do it justice today. So, 7 fans, if you're listening and I fuck up, I'm sorry, you know, feel free to correct me.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite one is 9.
Yeah.
And I just think 9 surpassed all of them, but we'll talk about that another day. So, today's topic is Final Fantasy 7, and it's my job to explain to Ben why he should give it a shot, why he should be more interested than he has been his whole life. So it's a tall order.
Yep.
Ben, what do you want to ask? What's your first?
I'll start with what I know about Final Fantasy VII. It's obviously a Japanese RPG. Yes. Main character is Cloud. He has a massive sword. The main villain is Sephiroth.
Correct.
So is it Sephiroth or Sephiroth?
It's Sephiroth, yeah. It's a f-f-f sound.
Okay. And he also has a massive sword. He's also half alien. And okay. They want to... It starts off with Cloud and his friend Barrett?
Barrett's good.
You know, being merciless terrorists, destroying an innocent power plant. And, you know, and then falling through a roof to find a flower girl who turns out to be a mystical angel or something.
Okay. You're not a million miles away from the beginning of the game. Okay. So, I guess in terms of setup, I guess I can correct a few things there. So, merciless terrorists, I mean, yeah, okay. That's one perspective on it, right? So the game kind of kicks off with Cloud being hired as a mercenary by this eco-terrorist group, I guess they're called, called Avalanche. And Barrett is a member of that group. Barrett and Cloud are not friends early on. They really don't get along, because Cloud won't join Avalanche, is the thing. And Barrett doesn't want him to join. He really doesn't like him at all. But Cloud won't join.
I'm glad you're telling me about this in detail.
Right? No, it's important. Yeah, you need to know about it, right? So he won't join, but he's hired as a mercenary because he has some inside knowledge of the building that they're going to try and infiltrate.
Okay.
Is basically why he's there. And then from there, it, you know, kind of proceeds and turns out that one of Cloud's childhood friends is a member of Avalanche now, Tifa, and she tries to persuade him to join, and it kind of takes off from there. As for Aeris and the Flower Girl, that's a little further down. It's actually, I think a lot of people forget how late into the game you meet Aeris. Like, not super late. It's not like a long time into the game, but every time I've replayed 7, I've always been surprised at how long it takes to meet her.
Okay.
It takes a little longer than I think most people remember.
Okay.
Yeah, so she's not there immediately. She's not really part of the setup. But she does become important quite later on. Yeah.
You've got Cloud, you got Barret and Tifa as the main three then. Is that it?
Or? Yeah. So that, I guess you could... Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so people love the characters of Final Fantasy VII. Like, possibly more than any other Final Fantasy game.
Yeah, I think so, right? Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, so the starting point, how do they capture that these characters are any good? Like, in what way are they relatable to the player from the start?
That's a good question. Yeah, so there's a couple of things that went into that, I think. Anyone who knows Final Fantasy now knows the name Tetsuya Nomura. Now he's like a big gun in Square Enix. He is like an executive producer, and he created Kingdom Hearts, and Final Fantasy 15 was like his baby. But when Final Fantasy 7 came out, he was quite a low-level guy, and he was basically just a character designer. And so he designed these characters, but they were the first Final Fantasy characters not designed by Yoshitaka Amano, who was the original guy. And I think Tetsuya Nomura's style was a lot more anime-influenced.
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, it was immediately going to be popular on another level than the original guys, who was more kind of illustrative and kind of, you know, very decorative, kind of old school illustration style. And he was great. Yoshitaka Amano was, you know, badass. But you're talking about like the 90s in Japan, especially anime was taken off in the West. It was already huge in Japan. So anything that looked like that was going to be really popular. So visually, there was something there that immediately people... mm-hmm. latched onto. They saw these new character designs, these new kind of art style, and went, oh wow, that's cool. When you start playing the game, yeah, there's a couple of things that are interesting to talk about here, and I don't want to talk too much about other games.
But you're going to anyway.
I am going to, and especially I don't want to talk too much about this particular game, because I think we can do a show on it in the future, but it's useful to compare this to Final Fantasy VIII, right? Because Final Fantasy...
Your most beloved.
Now stop. Don't even get me started on that fucking game. So Final Fantasy VIII's protagonist, Squall, is very similar to Cloud in the early stages of the games. The two of them are quite similar at the beginning. They're kind of stoic, you know, hard, emotionless kind of, you know, machine men kind of thing. And... the difference is that where Squall, I mean, the justification for him being the way he is comes so late into the game that it's just impossible to care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was. I just didn't like him.
Yeah.
So after, you know, two discs of just not liking the guy, when they finally explained, oh, here's why you don't like him, I'm like, oh, well, I don't care now. Like, I already hate the guy. Like, it doesn't matter. Right? But Squall, not Squall, Cloud, there's something really interesting that happens at the very beginning of Final Fantasy VII. Where you have your hard-ass mercenary guy, and he's really hard-ass, and he has kind of stupid hair, but he's, you know, he's got a big sword, and he's you know, he doesn't want to join the team. No, man, I'm not going to be part of your team. Like, it's, you know, it's typical kind of shit, but it's... what happens next is he meets Tifa. And when he meets Tifa, it's established they were childhood friends, and immediately, like, you're talking... I mean, depending on how good or bad you are at the game, you could get to this sequence in 20 minutes. So it's really early into the game. There's a flashback of when Cloud and Tifa were kids. And it's the two of them sitting at a well and in their hometown. And Cloud's talking about going off to Midgar to become a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And Tifa is like really, really unimpressed by his ambition. But she said, it's really clever the way it's done. Like, you can watch this scene on YouTube. It's really clever. He says that this big speech about, I'm going to join soldier, I'm going to be the best soldier ever. And she just says nothing. There's no speech bubble for her. Like, it's for the time.
Just ellipses or?
There's just nothing. She doesn't react at all. And like, I mean, maybe it was just laziness on the designer's part, but I would certainly interpret that as a really skillful kind of narrative thing of this character is just not interested in what this other character's saying, even though what he's saying is ostensibly pretty cool.
Yeah,
you know,
typical heroic thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Of like,
and she just doesn't care.
Yeah, yeah.
So then what she says to him after this big diatribe, she says to him, all right, well, look, if you're going to do that, make me one promise. Because she's kind of upset that, like, he's leaving, you know, and she says, make me one promise. If I'm ever in trouble, you're going to come and save me. And he's like, what? What are you talking about? I'm not doing that. What? I think he says what like three times, right? And she's just like, look, just promise me, all right? Just promise me that if I'm ever in trouble, you're going to come and save me. And he's like, all right, okay, fine, I promise, right? So, like, immediately after you're introduced to this cold-hearted kind of mercenary guy, like, almost immediately afterwards, you're shown explicitly that he wasn't always like that. Like, immediately, you get a glimpse into his past and a glimpse into this thing of he has this ambition, this huge ambition, this huge self-belief that he's going to go and do something great. And he has friends who believe in him and friends who kind of, who don't necessarily support or agree with the decisions he's making, but maybe they're too young to understand them, but are willing to kind of go, all right, if that's what you want to do, just don't forget about me. You know, if I ever need you, mm-hmm. come back and help me. You know, just don't forget about me. So, in comparison to Squall, I think that immediately we know, okay, this character has an arc. From the time he was a child when he left town, I shouldn't say child, maybe child's the wrong word, like when he left town to become a soldier, until now, something has happened.
Since his early teens to his late teens.
Yeah, right, yeah. Something has happened because he's not the same person. Right, so you go, this guy and this guy are not the same person. So there's something that happened here. So immediately I'm interested. I want to know, how did he get from that to that?
Mm-hmm.
Aside from Cloud, and in terms of character development, each character is, I mean, this isn't really a Seven specific thing, but all the characters are super unique. You know, like really, really, you can't ever get confused as to who's who. And I think in not so much Final Fantasy, but in certainly other JRPGs, like, I'm going to get so much shit if people listen to this, but the Tales series.
Yeah.
I've played a couple of Tales games, and after a while, I can't remember anyone's names. Like, they're all just so similar looking, and, mm-hmm. you know, and the names are all kind of weird anyway, you know, and there's very little actual individual characterization going on. And with Seven, that's definitely not the case. But Final Fantasy in general, it's not usually the case, but with Seven, all the characters are really, really unique. Now, I mean,
are they beyond archetypes, though? I mean, you're saying that they're unique, like, but, I mean, the soldier can be unique in a world where there aren't many soldiers. Like, are the characters, like, do they go through their own trials and tribulations, as it were? Like, do they last beyond the world that they inhabit?
I think so, yeah. And, to be honest, the world, you mentioned the world they inhabit. The world isn't in of itself a character in a way,
mm-hmm.
like the world of Midgar. Not so much the actual rest of the world, which is kind of not very interesting. But the city of Midgar and the opening sequence of the game that takes place exclusively in Midgar is really, really interesting on a bunch of different levels. And you spend a lot of time going from place to place and learning about the class system in Midgar and mm-hmm. the various different locations and where each location lies in the class system and why it lies there. And there's a lot of stuff that happens before the real story even begins
mm-hmm.
that kind of sets up this location and in a way kind of, not defines, but expands on the people in it. Like, when you learn that Sector 7, where Avalanche's base is, when you learn that that's the slums and that the plate above it is where all the rich people live, and there's a sequence, spoiler alert, there's a sequence in a little bit into Disc 1.
It's been 20 years.
It's been 20 years, so yeah, you know, yeah. There's a sequence a little bit into Disc 1 where, in order to stomp out Avalanche, in order to just put an end to them, the Shinra, who are the company running the whole thing, they decide they're going to drop the plate, which would wipe out everybody in the slums. Like, not just them, but it's the only... They're like, we have to kill them. This will kill them. It's like, well, it will kill everybody. Well, so what? You know, collateral damage. We've got to get rid of them. So that whole everything that leads up to that sequence, by the time you get to the point where the plate's going to drop on the slums and it's a really kind of intense action sequence trying to race to the top of the plate, you've been to so many different locations within that slum area and within Midgar that it really feels like you're part of that city. You know what I mean? So the city itself becomes a character, and it kind of helps to expand on the roles of each person within it. So I think, personally, those characters do transcend the limitations of their, like, their roles, mm-hmm. I guess you want to say, to an extent. I mean, there's another argument there about localization.
Yeah, I
mean, because
but, like,
Barrett.
Go on.
Most people will probably know what I'm about to say. Barrett had some interesting localization done to him as a character. He's like this. To be honest, I don't know who's at fault for it, because I mean, by the way, we're broadcasting this from Japan. We're broadcasting this from Saitama in my apartment, and we live in Japan, mm-hmm. and we've been living in Japan for a few years now,
yeah.
and we're kind of aware of certain intricacies of Japanese culture that other people might not be.
Yeah.
Not that we're experts, but you know. Nope. and Japan has a generally speaking has a strange relationship with other cultures.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, for some reason, I don't know what reason, but for some reason, the Japanese development team decided they wanted Barrett to be a black guy, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's great. Let's have a black guy. But he came out what a Japanese person understands a black guy to be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, I know, I've never played the Japanese version of the game, so I don't know how his dialogue is in the Japanese version of the game. But the English version, for whatever reason... And I'm going to, you know, I have to have faith in the localization team to an extent. So I'm going to guess they didn't do this on their own volition. I'm going to guess there was something in the Japanese language that forced them into this direction. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yep.
But he basically is Mr. T. Like, he just is. He talks like Mr. T. It's totally exaggerated and crazy. This, like over-the-top black guy dialogue. So, like, you're talking about, like, cliches and stuff, and it's like, yeah, well, if I'm going to stand here and say that the characters in Final Fantasy VII transcend their cliches, I can't not bring that up.
Does he start ironically selling chocolate bars or something halfway through?
No, but he does, like, he swears a lot, and he uses, like his English dialogue is like yo mama, like yo, like instead of you, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of vernacular. And like, I mean, it's fine, like, you know what I mean? It's not, I guess it's okay. At the time it didn't raise a lot of eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And you could, if you really wanted to, you could push a thing of, well, inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
That vernacular exists, so
yeah.
why not use it?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I guess that's fine, but it certainly does ring the cliche bell a little too heavy. You know what I mean? Like, when you're playing it, it's like, oh, come on, guys. Come on, you could have tried a little harder not to fall into that one, you know? But it's not that bad. And generally speaking, yeah, the other characters are all fleshed out really, really well, with the possible exception of the puppet character, Kate Sith,
mm-hmm.
who's, I mean, he's... I always got the impression he was there because every Final Fantasy up to that point had had six characters, and they wanted.
Like, we need another guy.
We need another one. You know, so it's like, damn, I want to go home. And there's a cat, and he rides a big doll. There, let's go home. Let's fucking call it a day.
Right, so. I mean, we kind of mentioned it a little bit early on, but we haven't really discussed it. Like, every time Final Fantasy VII in particular appears on the list, it's usually the saddest moment in any video game, and it's that stupid two-tone music.
Hey, like, Aerith's theme is beautiful. It's the most beautiful piece of music ever written.
And, you know, and it's Sephiroth dropping down what seems to be 50 feet, and and that's being, like, an actual estimation.
Look, don't bring logistics into this, man. Don't.
No, I'm not going to be too bad. But my issue, logistics-wise, is that his sword is curved,
yeah.
but it stabs. Logistically,
yeah,
it doesn't
seem to curved. It's a curved stab.
But yeah, so everybody talks about, Eris's death was so sad after she could have had a romance with Cloud, and she... could have, and she had, after, was it the prequel one, what's it called?
Crisis Core, yeah.
Yeah, Crisis Core, where she also had the relationship with Zack?
Zack, okay.
Yeah, so there's this continuation, she is central to this story, also because she's some sort of angel. Why does that death ring for so many people?
Because most of us spent fucking ages leveling her up.
So is it just like,
well, does that
the amount
of
effort you put in?
Look, I'm not gonna lie, man. There is that part of it. Anyone who says that's not the case either didn't level her up or is lying, right? Because for me, I mean, yeah, you can, like, she has one of the best limit break abilities in the whole game. She can, like, heal, like, up your ass. She's fucking amazing. She can heal everybody. And so you spend such a long time leveling her up and kind of getting these abilities and shit, and then she dies and you can't use her anymore. It's like, god damn it. Like, I just... That's how I was fighting. My entire kind of battle style was based around having her there, you know? So that there is that. And I think that was a really clever, at the time, kind of revolutionary idea. Mm-hmm. That this thing that you could have a character that you would have a, you know, a very functional use in the game that people would be used to and familiar with, and then just pull the rug out from under them and say, whoop, nope, you can't have her anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of games since then have done similar stuff. So I think at the time it was really revolutionary. As for the kind of emotional attachment to her, I mean, I think it is super sad when it happens. And I think the greatest tragedy of it is that she didn't deserve it. Like, you know, it was just this... There's a bunch of things there. But yeah, it was just... It was tragic because Cloud and... You could argue that Cloud and Tifa were kind of aggressively chasing Sephiroth, right? And trying to stop him from doing what he was doing.
Okay.
Right? Directly. Mm-hmm. Like, their goal was to find him and stop him, right? Aerith's goal was kind of different, and it's interesting because it's a plot point that seems to go over a lot of people's heads. Aerith never actually expresses, as far as I'm concerned, any direct desire to go after Sephiroth. What she wants to do is pray for something to stop what he wants to do. He wants to summon a meteor, and she wants to go to this ancient temple and pray for... the spell Holy, which will stop the meteor. So she's kind of sidelining Sephiroth completely. She's kind of going, well, I don't think we can stop him, but I think I can stop the thing he wants to do, right? So, you know, you could say that Cloud, if Sephiroth killed Cloud or Tifa, you can kind of go, well, they were fighting him. So, yeah, all's fair in love and war. They were fighting him and they lost, you know what I mean? But Aerith, she wasn't even thinking about Sephiroth. So...
She really did do nothing wrong.
She really did do nothing wrong, man. She really did nothing wrong. And the thing about the romance aspect of it is kind of controversial, because as far, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but as far as I'm aware, in the Japanese version of the game, Zack and Aerith it was not inferred that they had a romantic relationship.
Not even, but they were friendly.
Yeah, they were friendly. They knew each other.
Yeah.
But the romantic relationship seems to be something that I can't remember offhand if it was actually in the game, but it's something that Western fans have really latched onto. And it's not something that exists in the fandom in Japan.
But, I mean, you know, fandoms do go crazy shipping random people.
Yeah, that's true. And even that's a very Western thing. Like, Japanese fans don't really do that either. So, like, the romance element of it, I mean, yeah, that's a thing that people talk about. But anyone who knows anything about Final Fantasy VII, who really knows what they're talking about, kind of knows that there's no love story in Seven. That Cloud is, you know, he's incapable of love.
Right? I've seen the YouTube videos. Him and Barrett have a lovely date on the Ferris wheel. They are so adorable. And they belong together. Why? And Barrett already has a small child. Like, they can have a beautiful family. Why are you stopping this?
Yeah, right? Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. That would be very romantic. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. So the romance thing I never bought into. I don't really care about that personally, because I think Cloud and Tifa are much better. You know, they're friends. And that's all they can ever be. And I think anyone who argues against that is kind of missing the point. And Aerith never really offers that to Cloud. She's never very interested. Like, there's really very little in the way of a direct reference to romance. You can certainly infer a lot from their behavior and some of the stuff they say, but there's no direct love thing there. Cloud cares for her, but she dies before he ever gets an opportunity to express that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then Cloud beats himself up for fucking 20 years until Advent Children about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like literally a thing of, you could say it's a love story, I guess, because he loves her, but it never goes anywhere.
Yeah.
And so in the end, it becomes more of a redemption story.
Okay.
Like, by the time you get to Advent Children, it's really more about Cloud getting over the fact that he couldn't save her, as opposed to lamenting the fact that he never loved her. You know what I mean? So I don't think the romance element is a very interesting argument. I think it kind of leads you to a lot of dead ends. Mm-hmm. You can go, is there a love story in Final Fantasy VII? Well, look at Tifa, they're kind of friends, doesn't really go anywhere than that. Look at Aerith, well, she dies and then Cloud spends the rest of his life moping. You know what I mean? So... there's
did
not
he
really
become school.
Yeah, right. Yeah, basically. And one of the best parts of Advent Children is when Tifa calls him out on it. Although in the English version, she calls him out on it in a really weird way. Like in the Japanese one, she uses like a Japanese slang term that I can't remember what it is, but it means like, I think it's guru guru, which is like you're just going round and round. Mm-hmm. Like you're not going anywhere. You're just going in circles. But in the English version, she says dilly dally shilly shally. And I remember, I think
Final
I was
Final
like...
Final Fantasy 16, Diddy like, Daddy Shitty Shitty.
What age were we when that came out? Like, I can't remember how old I was, but I was old enough to go, what the fuck was that? That does not have the gravitas of what she's saying at all. That's just so lame. So fucking hang your head in shame, whoever fucking translated that shit. But yeah, so, you know, the romance thing I don't really care about. Personally,
but so what about story wise then? Like, because obviously she's trying to stop this meteor. She is the last. All right, I'm trying.
Yeah, go on.
She is the last ancient one.
Yeah. Okay. You're mixing up your Marvel and your Final Fantasy. She's the last ancient.
And she's the last ancient. Who can do weird magic things.
Okay.
And this is proving my ignorance time and time again on this subject. But yeah, She has the power to stop, like, to pray away this meteor.
Well, she thinks so, yeah.
Does she actually?
She believes she does. If basically she is what's called, she's the last line, the last of a line of, like, ancient people called the Cetra. And, or Ketra. It's a text-based Final Fantasy game, so no one knows what the hell the pronunciation actually is for these things. But I always said Cetra. And the Cetra are like an ancient race that supposedly know the location of somewhere called the Promised Land. And the Promised Land is supposedly brimming with the Mako energy that the Shinra Company are using. Mm-hmm. Right? So they want to find this Promised Land. So they've been searching out all the ancients. Mm-hmm. And Aerith is the last one left. So she doesn't acknowledge in-game, apart from the battle sequences, obviously, any actual powers per se. But she is connected to that line of people. And so she has got abilities, I suppose. You could infer that she has abilities, for sure. But Cloud's determination to protect her, I mean, it kind of comes from that, because he does find out about that, and that becomes a motivation. But my interpretation for that whole relationship was that she was the first person late in his... like, at this point in his life, that showed him any kind of genuine affection. Like, you had Tifa, who was his childhood friend, you know, and she was there when he was a kid. And so for her to come into his life, back into his life now, and say, hey, I'm still here for you, it's like, okay, that's cool, but you've always been there. Mm-hmm. So it's not really surprising. And it doesn't really invalidate any of my current insecurities, because you've always been there. Whereas when he met Aerith, she shows him a lot of kindness, and she's kind of very accepting of him, and she wants to kind of hang out with him, and she gives him the time of day, essentially, you know.
Helps him up when he falls through the roof
exactly.
of a church.
Yeah, exactly. And
like all heroes do.
Which, by the way, I mean another thing that we kind of have to talk about, I don't know if it's on your list of queries, but it's a really difficult thing to talk about, because it's so hard to nail down, but the general atmosphere of the game, particularly in the opening kind of Midgar sequence, that from the moment when you fall into the church, like, I think it's about a 15-minute sequence of just walking around with Aerith, and it's like one of the high points of the game for me, because like nothing really happens, but you're just kind of walking around with her, and she's telling you a little bit about where she lives, and you kind of learn a little bit about Midgar, and you see some new locations that you haven't seen before, and the music is really relaxing and really cool, and it's kind of a really nice respite from the chaos that had happened before and the chaos that comes after. And it's something that Final Fantasy up until 12 always seemed to do really, really well. Which is
pacing,
just balancing this kind of you had your heart-pounding action sequences where you had battles and chases and stuff like this, and then suddenly there would be like a calm. Mm-hmm. And you could just wander around the little village and stuff, and you could take your time with it. And not even just that you could wander around, because you can do that in most RPGs, but there would be a specific plot point or plot points that would happen in this time. Mm-hmm. And they would not be specifically related to what was going on a bigger scale, but they would help you to understand the characters, maybe, or they'd help you to understand the world a little bit more.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's small things like that that separate Final Fantasy from a lot of the early JRPG crop for me. And that sequence where you're walking around with Aeris, it's just, it always sticks in my mind. It always sticks in my mind. And every time I've replayed Final Fantasy VII, when I get to that part, I'm always really, really happy and really stoked that I'm there.
All right. So my last thing on like the characters, from somebody who apparently did nothing wrong to somebody who really did nothing wrong, i.e. Sephiroth. The guy is a complete angel. Like, he's not just one-winged, he's total angel. You did nothing wrong. He's an absolute hero of the planet by trying to destroy it. And, you know, just clean slate and start again.
Why do you think that? Why do you think destroying the planet is the way to go?
I have no idea. I've never played the game.
Okay, right, so Sephiroth did nothing wrong. Okay. It's an interesting argument. It's an interesting argument. And I think a lot of people...
That's our first t-shirt.
A lot of people would be open to the argument that Sephiroth is a tragic figure. Mm-hmm. I don't think there'd be a lot of people who would argue against that. You know, he learns that his origins are not what he believed them to be. Right? Mm-hmm. And his origins are pretty horrible, right? And they're very different from what he was told growing up and what he always believed they were. So when he finds out, he basically finds out that his whole kind of existence is the result of just rampant, uncontrolled experimentation. That he's just this crazy genetic accident that kind of happened in a lab. Mm-hmm. And
the best kind of genetic,
right? Yeah. But the when he discovers that, like, when he discovers that he is not human, I guess you could say he's not human, obviously he's plagued with self-doubt and kind of, what if I'm not human, what am I? Mm-hmm. You know. And so he, when this happens in the game, it happens during a flashback sequence, and he locks himself in, I think it's called Shinra Manor. Although I don't know why it's called Shinra Manor, because it's nowhere near Midgar. But
Is it like the Resident Evil Manor?
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. It's like, I think maybe I'm wrong. Someone can comment maybe and let me know if I'm wrong about that. I think it's called Shinra Manor. It's in Nibelheim. It's in Cloud and Tifa's hometown. And he and Cloud and a couple other guys are sent out to examine a Mako reactor that has been malfunctioning. And while there... Well, this is kind of a hot topic, because this was kind of retconned in Crisis Core. And the plot, as nonsensical as it was in the original game, has become even more obtuse and difficult to fucking comprehend. But basically, while there, I won't go into specifics of why he discovers this, because, again, it's different in the original game from Crisis Core. I don't know which one to go with, but he discovers the truth about his origins. He discovers that he's not human. Mm-hmm. And he locks himself in Shinra Manor in the library, looking through all of the Shinra scientist research notes, trying to piece together his history, trying to piece together where he came from and who he is. And he discovers the truth. He discovers that he was created from this alien creature thing that they found called Genova. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert on Seven, but if I've got this wrong, someone please correct me. My interpretation of it, or my memory of it, is that he believes Genova to be not one of the ancients, not one of the Cetra, but like superseding the Cetra. Like she was the correct, rightful owner of the Earth.
Oh.
And that the Cetra were kind of another thing that aren't as important as everyone else thinks they are. So he thinks, wow, she's my mother, basically. I was created from her, mm-hmm. and she was the correct, rightful owner of the Earth. Mm-hmm. That means that I am now the heir to the Earth, right? But like you said, he doesn't really have a lot of, high hopes for the Earth. So he wants to pulverize it, but not just pulverize it. And this is kind of where his motivations get interesting. He wants to become God. So it's not just about blatant destruction. He wants to become powerful. And the way he'll become powerful kind of bleeds into something that I think we're going to get to later, which is like the kind of eco message that lies beneath a lot of what's going on in Final Fantasy VII. Basically, the belief is that when the planet is hurt, something called the life stream comes and heals it. So like when you, if you, for example, if you like rip a tree out of the ground and then 2 days later the soil has grown over, it was the life stream that did that. The life stream came and healed the wound, essentially, right? So his thinking is, well, if the wound is big enough, then the Earth will have to summon a lot of this life stream. I'll take it all. If I am at the nexus where this is all converging, I will become a godlike being.
I love megalomania.
Right? Yeah, right? So that's his motivation. And his motivation come from the fact that he has this disdain for humanity because humanity created him, you know, out of recklessness and then lied to him his whole life about who he was, you know, and then essentially kind of forced him into... Like kind of, what would you say, complicit subjugation of his mother?
Yeah.
Because they had Genova locked away, you know what I mean? They had all these Genova samples locked away, so he was kind of involved in that.
Yeah.
So it kind of drove him crazy. And yeah, you can understand his motivations. Like, he's certainly not an unsympathetic villain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'd say he did nothing wrong.
I mean, the burning of, what's its face, the Cloud's hometown.
Nibelheim, yeah.
Yeah, it needed to happen.
Why? Why are we talking about?
It was
about
an eyesore.
What, you fucking gentrification now? Like, what's this? Fucking gentrification Gaia, like.
Yeah.
Motherfucker.
Hey,
could have just swung in, opened up some hipster cafes. That would have done the trick, right?
Yeah.
Make it cool.
Yeah. Yeah, get some really nice beach resorts, condos and stuff going
on. Yeah, then
there.
Noctis and his crew would have definitely swung in there. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
See, now you're talking something that I actually understand.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. All right. Well, one other thing that you mentioned was the story, and I guess we're going to go further into that, but before we do, I should say that I'm not a particularly big fan of how Seven lays out its story.
I think going too much into stories, particularly with Final Fantasy, and like, I mean, if we ever do it, God forbid, we do Kingdom Hearts, and you try and explain the story to me,
try and explain it to myself first.
the convoluted nature of it, it's just too much.
Absolutely.
So I think just like basically. Maybe tell me first of all, let's talk about it. Like, you kind of briefly mentioned there, what is the major theme, why are there all these eco themes going through this, like what are they, and does it really impact the plot? Is it central, or is it central to the characters? Even I mean, clearly it is to Eris, because she's trying to, you know, pray away. It clearly is to Sephiroth because it's his whole giant master plan.
Mm.
But the others, do they care even?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, I guess. The thing about the eco theme with Final Fantasy, with Seven, it's very much in your face from the get-go. Like, these guys are referred to as eco-terrorists. Mm-hmm. And Barrett kind of goes on big diatribes about how the Shinra Company are destroying the planet. And they're kind of funneling the Mako energy out of the planet, and it's killing the planet. And that's why he wants to destroy Shinra, to save the Earth. So it's from the get-go, it's a very on-the-nose eco message towards the player.
Do you get a hippie power at any point? Like flower punch or something?
You don't get anything like that. No, you don't get anything like that.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, you do get something called Healing Wind, which is Eris' ability. So, I mean, you could, you know... There's a bunch of ways you could think about that, but let's not go too far down that rabbit hole. So the eco message is there, like from the get-go towards the player. But the interesting thing there is that Hironobu Sakaguchi, it was the creator of Final Fantasy and kind of stayed on until, I think his last one in charge was 10.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was involved in 12, but not to the same extent.
Mm.
Which is kind of where it started to go downhill.
No, really?
Yeah, so I think his last one that he was directly in charge of was 10. Again, I could be wrong on that, but I think that's right. He, like, almost always, there is an eco message in his work. Like, 9 times out of 10. If you're playing a Hironobu Sakaguchi game, there is some kind of eco-preaching going on some level. And it most blatantly in that fucking god-awful Final Fantasy movie, The Spirits Within. Like, yeah, yeah. I mean, you couldn't get a more blatant eco-message at all. But anyway, so Final Fantasy VII's message is, yeah, that the planet basically... There's a moment into... I think it's Disc 1, could be Disc 2... where you go to a place called Cosmo Canyon. And Cosmo Canyon is kind of like a kind of Native American-looking kind of place. And the vibe is that these are people who are in touch with the Earth, that they're not technologically advanced, they're not any of this stuff. They're very nature-based people, okay. Right? And it's where Red, the dog character, it's where he comes from.
Okay.
And you meet a guy called Bugenhagen. And... he goes on this kind of lecture, I guess it is. And it's at the time, the lecture scene is actually quite cool, because you have to remember, you can watch it on YouTube, if you search for Bugenhagen's lecture, you can find it. At the time, you're talking about, like, Mario 64 was the pinnacle of graphical capabilities at this time. So this sequence has, like, kind of 3D planets kind of spinning around characters' heads, and kind of, you know, at the time, it was hugely... really, really cool to watch. Mm-hmm. And it takes place in this planetarium. And it's kind of like a holographic galaxy. And the characters are listening to Bugenhagen talk about the nature of the universe and the nature of the life stream. And this is where you find out what the life stream actually is. It's where a lot of the threads are kind of tied together. And the whole thing about Seven's world is that, yeah, the planet is harmed by... it's like continuously harmed by human life. Human life and human existence is continuously harming the planet, but human death is continuously healing the planet. So it's this idea that the planet is fine because humans will live on it and damage it incrementally, but we also die on it. So, and when we die on it, we return to the life stream and we heal all the damage.
So Sephiroth is right. He wants to kill all of them and heal the planet at the exact same time while also sucking the life energy.
Yeah, but why is the planet your main priority? Why isn't the millions of people on it not important? Like, the planet isn't suffering because the life stream is constantly healing. It's perfect balance. Everything is balanced. And that's what needs to happen in the universe, according to Bugenhagen. That balance is good. But what's happening with Shinra is that Shinra have found a way to extract the life stream in the form of Mako energy. And that they are kind of regressing the balance. They're pulling out more than the planet is getting back.
Fossil fuels.
Yeah, right? So here we go. This is where the fucking browbeating comes, right? So that's the kind of, you know, there's the message there. Mm. It's like, everything needs to be in balance. I mean, everything's in balance, we're okay. But if you're pulling out more than you're putting back in, you're going to have a lot of shit going on.
I mean, so, you know, coming from a guy who designed, like, you know, respect the message and all the rest of it, but his message is also going out on masses of plastic discs.
Well, not anymore. We live in the download era now, baby.
I mean, yeah, now. But, like, we're talking about 1997, and there were 4 of them in each box.
Yeah, but you can't shoot the messenger, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know.
No, the message is fine, yeah. Mm. The message is, it's obviously an important one, and even in 1997, it wasn't,
it wasn't something that a lot of games were doing.
It's certainly that, but, like, even people weren't talking about it huge, like, in comparison to today.
Yeah.
I mean, we were kids, so I don't...
No, sure. But as a kid, even playing it, this is why I think that Square Enix... Not Square Enix, at the time they were Squaresoft. Squaresoft, in the PlayStation 1 era, up until, like, halfway through the PlayStation 2's life cycle, like, immediately after Final Fantasy X, that was, like, the golden age for Squaresoft as a company. Because... It really felt like, on every single level, gameplay, story, everything, they were speaking up to their audience. It was like, we've got a point to make with this game, and it's gonna transcend, like, just kind of battling and winning battles and you know, a hero story. No. Every game's gonna have a point and a real kind of moral and something that's gonna make you think. And every game generally did. I mean, you can talk about how well they executed it. That's a different thing. But every game did have that kind of thing. Like, Xenogears is a masterpiece, but it's weird. It's weird. It's all about, like, humans' relationship to God and what is God and what is religion. And did we create, like, God in the image of ourselves, or did we create, like, did we interpret ourselves in the image of this god? Like, it's a bizarre game, and it's something that just could not be made now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the AAA kind of, okay, we got to push for sequels and kind of, so that's definitely going to make loads of money. It would just never get greenlit now.
We'll come back to that
one. Maybe as an indie game. But it certainly wouldn't get greenlit at Square Enix. Like, there's no way.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, that era was really special, and Final Fantasy VII was the kickoff for that. So there is that message in it, and I think that holds a lot of weight even now.
On that though, like, I mean, you're saying like Final Fantasy was the kickoff of everything, like the start of this Squaresoft like revolution, like,
well, it was the one that pushed it out.
Yeah.
They had already been quietly kind of doing it. Like, you could,
yeah,
I'm sure people would say Chrono Trigger had a really important message, and I would agree, but Final Fantasy VII was the mainstream breakout of it, you know?
Oh, yeah. So, in doing that, though, I mean, like, Final Fantasy came from, like, traditional tabletop Western RPGs. Dungeons & Dragons and all the rest of it, and all those kind of games. That's where, like, they wanted to create a Dungeons & Dragons video game, basically. Particularly the first one.
Okay.
Is 7 the first one where they really break away from that and try and do something independent? Like,
No, I don't think so. I think that 7 is... one of the reasons that I think 7 was as popular as it was at the time, and also simultaneously one of the reasons I don't consider it personally now a very good entry in the series. Like, I should qualify that. At the time, it was great, but I really genuinely believe it has been surpassed, like, so many times over by now. Mm-hmm. I don't get the rose tinted glasses about 7. Like,
yeah.
I loved it at the time, but, I mean, 8 looked better, like, in terms of graphical fidelity, it looked better. Style-wise, I don't think it looked better, but, you know, in terms of pixels, it looked better. 9 did just about everything better than 7. 10 was also, like, at an all other level, and even other companies, like Konami, they copped on. They did stuff like, what was it? I can't remember the name of the game now, but they released a game that was very similar to Final Fantasy, and used a lot of Final Fantasy's ideas, but developed on them. Mm. So, like, the idea that 7 is the holy grail, I just don't accept. But back to your question, what it did really well, and also the reason why I don't hold it up very well now, is that it was very similar to Final Fantasy VI in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
That I think it felt familiar enough to Final Fantasy fans. But anyone who hadn't played a Final Fantasy game before literally had never seen anything like this. It was one of those moments where you're playing it for the first time and you're going, I don't understand what to do here. You know what I mean? You play a platformer, you know you go left.
Mm-hmm.
You play a 3D platformer, you know you move forward.
Yeah.
My first time playing Final Fantasy VII, having never played a Final Fantasy before, I was just like, what is this? Like, I just did not know what to do, because the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. So when you finally kind of learn how to do it, it's totally unique. There's literally nothing else like it up to that point. So you had the perfect storm. You had it. It was familiar enough to the one directly before it. It's quite different from 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, but it was close enough to 6 in terms of its battle style and the battle menus,
mm-hmm,
that it was Final Fantasy fans. It still felt like a Final Fantasy to them, but it was, you know, unique enough to people who hadn't played Final Fantasy that it drew them in because it was interesting. So, yeah, I mean, that's the reason why I think it kicked off. Not so much anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the stuff about the, you know, the whole thing of people who say, oh, I don't like him. He has like a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and you go, I don't like him for his looks. I like him for his personality.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's probably true, but the looks are the first door. You know what I mean? There has to be something. There has to be something there that
You can't go back and play Final Fantasy then,
right?
Now.
Exactly. You can't, right? Do it. So, when you're talking about like the message and the character development and the music and all these things, and they're all there and they're all fantastic, but that's not what hooked people in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's all very late into the game.
Yeah.
what hooked people in was the fact that it was A, very similar to what either they'd already seen, mm-hmm. or B, it was like nothing else they'd seen before ever.
Yeah.
So you had this perfect storm of fans, fans and non-fans who flocked to it for different reasons.
Okay. You just said, though, that the music was fantastic and all the rest of it. Now, my only entry into Final Fantasy is 15, which you lent me, mm-hmm. and which you can buy... and listen to the different soundtracks yeah. of the games.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get it. I don't get 7 soundtrack. Like, I understand that it's MIDI and that you can listen to it in orchestral and all the rest of it, and it'll be very nice. I just don't... am I missing something really... Like, is it because of the moments that you're in the game?
But yeah, you're missing the game. That's what you're missing.
But, like, listening to One Winged Angel and stuff like that, and the Aerith theme by itself...
Mm.
I was just like driving around in my beautiful hot pink, disgusting looking regalia,
that game allows you to be obnoxious. Like,
I love it.
It provides a platform for your bad taste. It's fantastic.
We're going to talk about Saints Row and why I love that game one day. Do you just have to be so in it at the time for it to work?
I think you're right. I think that is it. I think it's about placement. Like, Tifa's theme, the first time you hear Tifa's theme, when you hear Final Fantasy music orchestrated, mm-hmm. especially the older titles, because from 9 onwards, from 8 onwards, really, from 8 onwards, they kind of got their shit together, and it doesn't sound nearly as MIDI.
Mm-hmm.
And it most of it sounds... pretty high quality, and you know, they were on the PlayStation, so they realized they could use WAVs and they could use like proper full-on high quality audio. So from 8 onwards, I mean, the music's in a different realm quality wise but for 7, you know, the I think that, yeah, if you don't have that nostalgia element to it, the sound quality is definitely a barrier, I would imagine, because mm-hmm. you've got that really old school gnarly MIDI engine kind of gurgling away, and it doesn't sound great. Now, the other thing, and I don't want to get too heavy into this, because for anyone who's listening and doesn't know me personally, I am a music geek.
No.
Right, like hugely. And I know most people who listen to this stuff won't be music geeks, so I don't want to go in all heavy on the fucking terminology and shit. But basically, what you're looking at with Nobuo Uematsu, the guy who made the score for Final Fantasy 1-10,
mm-hmm.
and then he also did some work on 12, but not a lot. This guy, obviously has an orchestral background, but he is primarily a pop music fan. And like his biggest, I interviewed for my university dissertation, I interviewed Arnie Roth, who's the conductor on the Final Fantasy tours. And I asked him, who is Nobuo Uematsu's biggest influence? You know, I was expecting him to say like Haydn or Beethoven or something, right? And he was like, probably Elton John. Like, what? Really? It's like, yeah, because he always thinks about, when he's writing a melody, he always imagines that someone's going to be singing it. Mm. Even though nobody is singing it, it's going to be instrumental. But he always imagines that it's a vocal melody. So he comes at it from a pop point of view, basically. But one thing he does that is very classical, he does this thing called leitmotif. And it's Wagner did this, basically invented this term leitmotif. And he used it in his operas to reference specific characters. Within the opera. So even if this character wasn't on the stage...
Having a musical cue for characters.
Each character, So even if the character wasn't on stage, you heard this cue and you would understand something was happening with them. They were being mm-hmm. referenced in some way, right? Mm-hmm. And so he uses this a lot, and to the point where if you look at a Final Fantasy soundtrack track listing, you will see Tifa's theme, Cloud's theme, Aerith's theme, mm-hmm. right? Everyone has a theme.
Mm-hmm.
And also a lot of the locations have their own specific theme. Now, he doesn't do anything tremendously interesting with that in the same way someone like John Williams would. Whereas when John Williams, for example, in Star Wars, when Darth Vader and Luke are fighting, it's Darth's theme literally playing against Luke's theme. The mm-hmm. music is having a fight.
Yeah.
And Nobuo Uematsu doesn't really do that.
Yeah.
So there's nothing tremendously interesting going on, but the themes are really closely linked to the characters that they are mm-hmm. connected to, because that's when you hear them. So the first time you meet Aerith, Actually, no. The first thing we Eris isn't Eris theme. It's a song called "Flowers Growing in a Church."
Okay.
And it's this soft little kind of electric piano thing. It's really beautiful. The first time you hear Eris theme, I think, is in her house when her mother is telling you about her history. So Eris isn't there, and Eris's adopted mother is telling you, the player, and telling Cloud about. She's an ancient and she's being pursued by Shinra because she's an ancient and, you know, I'm worried about her all this. And it very closely links that piece of music to that character and to an aspect of that character, specifically in Eris's case, tragedy. The fact that she can't live her life, that she's a prisoner of her own heritage, essentially.
Yeah.
The first time you hear Tifa's theme, it's when Tifa confronts him in the bar and confronts him about their childhood promise to protect her that he has apparently forgotten. So immediately you're tying Tifa's theme to a sadness, to a thing of a nostalgic longing for the past that isn't there anymore.
But is that nostalgic longing? Like, is that not also seen in Final Fantasy VII fans who talk about this music as if it's glorious?
But it is glorious. That's the thing. It is glorious, man.
It's glorious.
It's objectively speaking, I really, really genuinely believe it's beautiful music. I think that the fact that you can put it in so many different arrangements, like there are piano arrangements of Tifa's theme and there's orchestral. Well, actually, they've never done an orchestral version of Tifa's theme, which they really should. But the fact that there are so many different arrangements of Seven music and it always works. Like, it always, in the different arrangements, it never sounds forced. That, to me, is the sign of kind of objectively good music. Mm-hmm. That if it can transcend its instrumentation into other instrumentations and still come out damn good, that is objectively good, as far as I'm concerned. But, yeah, you're onto something. I don't think it will have the same impact if you are not experiencing it for the first time with the intended character information.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I said, the first time I hear Tifa's theme is when Tifa is upset because Cloud has forgotten a part of their childhood.
Yeah.
I think we all can relate to that idea of, you know, holding on to a childhood memory and then finding out that it's not as important as you believed it was.
Yeah.
And going, oh, man. You know, so that music is tied very closely to a specific emotion being experienced by a specific character.
Mm.
And so when it's called back later, of course, all that baggage comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with Aerith's theme, you know, so all those themes are kind of connected like that. And also there's just stuff, like, there's other stuff that's kind of more frivolous, that isn't quite as intense, like the Golden Saucer location has that really chirpy music. And it's like, all the fans love that. And that's not because the Golden Saucer has any fantastic plot points. It's because it's a fun place. It's cool. You know, it's a fun place to be. So it's kind of, you know, yeah. When you experience the game and you hear the music connected to what's going on and you're already invested to an extent, of course, it makes you feel a better connection to that music. Listening to it while you're driving around without ever having experienced that, I can't imagine. Yeah, I would not. I'm not surprised when you say it's not doing that for you.
Yeah,
because
you need to go through that.
You need to go through it. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's fair enough. Okay. So, what time are we on?
We are coming up on an hour.
Last thing then.
Okay.
All right. It's been 20 years since the original.
Yeah.
Nomura has supposedly confirmed that Kingdom Hearts 3 is coming out. It's never coming out. Like, so, which means that the Final Fantasy VII remake is on its way in some form or another.
Yep.
All right. It's been 20 years. Nomura himself, didn't he say, like, why do people insist on a Final Fantasy VII remake?
Yeah.
But now, we're probably 21 years after the fact. We've moved on a lot in technology. Uh-huh. The trailer looks great, but we don't know how it's actually going to play out. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, we've all had that experience, particularly more so in recent years, of trailers looking fantastic, games not so much.
Yep.
Do you think, like, why are we still talking about this? Why did we make this the first topic of a podcast?
Okay.
Like,
so there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, let's not be under any illusions here. The reason that this is getting remade, and the reason that there has been a clamor to have it remade, and the reason we're still talking about it is because of the right time, right place. Final Fantasy VII came out on a new, exciting platform that brought thousands, if not millions of people into games that were not into it before that. Sony made games cool. You know what I mean? Like, before Sony, games were the nerdy shit.
Sonic, right? Is going to be so angry at
you. You might know, but exactly, right? Like, they were kid stuff, you know? And yeah. If you were a grown man, you were playing a Sega Mega Drive, you're playing Sonic the Hedgehog, you were kind of looked down on. You were oh, what the hell are you doing? Grow up, you know what I mean? Then the PlayStation came out, and everything changed. Like, suddenly it was cool. It was cool to have a gaming device. It was like, oh, that's sweet. You know, it's awesome. It's like high tech. It's not like a little toy.
It's got discs and everything.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool. So Sony brought tons of people in. So you're talking about a massive influx of new fans, right? So basically, yeah, like I said before, you've got all the old fans plus tons of new fans. It was many people's first Final Fantasy. And even for the people who had played Final Fantasy before, it was the first 3D Final Fantasy. And it's like comparing Mario 1 versus Mario 64. You know what I mean? It's a huge leap.
Yeah.
It's massive. So, Final Fantasy VII was the perfect game at the perfect time. Right. Because, that's why it was, you know, so hugely popular, and that's why it's still popular now, because it holds that place in people's hearts as the first Final Fantasy they played in many cases. I mean, it's certainly the first one I played, you know what I mean? So that's why it's there, and that's why it has that nostalgic element to it that people just can't let go of.
Mm-hmm.
As for why the remake, I mean, look, I don't want the remake. Personally, I'm really against it.
But it's going to have everything. It's going to have a full timeline and everything.
See, here's the thing, man. Here's the thing. I remember having this conversation with one of my buddies in university, and I was railing against it. And my argument was, I was like, look, you can't, on the one hand, criticize George Lucas for putting loads of CGI into the original Star Wars trilogy and re-releasing it, you know, not the same. And you know, and criticizing him going, you can't fuck with your fucking original vision, man. The original was so much better. And then in the same breath go, oh yeah, Final Fantasy VII Remake, let's do that. Like, it's the same principle as far as I'm concerned.
It's not, though.
I think it is. As far as, I think it is. I think the original is there, and it's there, warts and all. Mm-hmm. And if you want to experience Final Fantasy VII, you can experience it the way it was envisioned. You can experience it the way it was birthed. And I think that's important. Now,
was it envisioned as a turn-based combat thing?
Yeah.
Do you think if they start it now, it would still be turn-based combat?
Well, come on, man. You can't ask that kind of hypothetical question. That's a ridiculous question. That's a ridiculous question. They didn't start it now.
Yeah.
And that's what's important, right? Okay. They started it in the 90s, and they revolutionized the RPG genre for years afterwards, right? So that's there. The original is there. You can play it on every platform. You can play it on Android, PC, PS4, PS3, PSP, PS Vita, toaster oven. You can play it on absolutely everything, right? So there's no excuse. If you want to play Final Fantasy VII, you can play it, right? I don't want a remake. Because the remake, I just can't imagine a universe where it's not a letdown. Now, here's the other thing. When I said all this to my mate in university and we were having this big debate, he totally destroyed my argument by saying, yeah, are you going to buy it? I was like, well, yeah. He's like, of course I'm going to buy it. Like, of course I'm going to buy it. Don't be stupid. That's a fucking stupid thing to say. But at the same time, like, I don't think it's a good idea. I would prefer not to buy it.
Mm.
You know, I prefer they didn't give me the option to have to buy it.
Well, just don't buy it.
No, I'm going
to
buy it. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, I'm definitely going to buy it. But, like, as for...
What does Square do? Are there discs laced with cocaine or something? Like, every Squaresoft or Square Enix fan I know is just obsessed with, like, they're like, oh man, Kingdom Hearts 2.8 comes out, oh, it means I gotta buy it, a fucking Square, like, just don't buy it. Like,
yeah, it's not some kind of fucking mind control, man. It's not cool.
I
mean, and you think it's just us, but it's Dragon Quest in Japan, like,
I know people
who fucking never play games, but they bought Dragon Quest.
Dragon 11 just came 11, out.
Yeah. I know people who don't play games, and they've kind of made fun of me for playing games. I'm like, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, I waited in line for 3 hours to buy Dragon Quest. It's like, oh, God, you fucking hypocrite. Like, you know. So, yeah, like, Square Enix have got some kind of fucking spell on people. But as for what, like, you know, why, yeah, that's why we're still talking about it, I think. That it came at the right place at the right time, and people have rose-tinted nostalgia glasses about it. In terms of the actual remake, like I said, I'm not in favor of it.
But, like, Is there nothing beyond that though? Is it just nostalgia? Is that why it's important?
I think so. No, not why it's important.
Well, why
it's important because, like, the stuff that we talked about before, all the stuff that we talked about the last hour, it was the first game to really do that. It was the first game to do that stuff on a big level. And if you look at not just RPGs, but like AAA console games pre and post Final Fantasy VII, they're very different,
mm-hmm.
right? Post Final Fantasy VII, there is a huge increase in games that focus on narrative. Like, massive.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where narrative was inconceivable in games that came pre Final Fantasy VII. There was a couple of games that did it, but they were unusual.
I think the Earthworm Jim narrative. Story of
my
lifetime.
You know, Squaresoft had a lot of really hardcore RPGs like Secret of Mana and Chrono Trigger that had great narratives.
Yeah.
But they were very much the... Square Enix were outliers. Like, it was very much the exception. Like, games up to that point were still very much run left, get the things,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's that. Whereas after Final Fantasy VII, that all shifted. And suddenly it was like, no. You should have a good story. It's not just an option anymore. It's something that you should do because it makes a huge difference. And so it's important for that reason. Where I disagree with remaking it and where I fall off that argument and jump into the nostalgia glasses argument is that I think even just looking at Final Fantasy, and you could make this argument much stronger by looking elsewhere, but I'm gonna be conservative, right? I'm gonna say even just looking at Final Fantasy, it's been bettered. It's not like its ideas were good enough to be developed on and improved later. So when people say, "Oh, seven is the best one," that's pure nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. It's people who can't accept that the thing that they hold in their heart, in the little golden nugget in their heart, has been improved upon. And I don't understand that because, like, in order to get to the apex of perfection that is Final Fantasy IX, right? In order to get there,
why do you want so much hate on our first episode?
We had to start. Look, fucking
We're not doing it now.
Final Fantasy IX fans represent. They know what I'm talking about, right? But in order to get there, let's make it fair. In order to get to how kind of pristine Final Fantasy VIII looked,
mm-hmm.
in order to get to how organic every aspect of Final Fantasy IX was, in order to get to the, like, really, really strong narrative punch of 10,
mm-hmm.
in order to get to all of those places, we had to start somewhere solid. Mm-hmm. You can't get to those places from shaky ground.
Yeah.
So when I say that 7 was bettered and is not the best anymore, people take that like I'm kicking them in the face. I'm like, I'm not. No, 7 is fantastic. It's vital. It's hugely important. Possibly the most important. But is it the best? No.
Mm.
Not anymore.
It's the foundation stone that you don't need to see anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And
you love knowing it's there, but you don't...
You don't. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
Like, and if you go back and play it, like, I mean, I can't imagine it holds up to kids. You know what I mean?
Dude, like, I mean, looking at it, and you got clouds, like, weird beach ball, two beach
He's
balls
got, like,
connected
hooves.
Together.
He's got hooves. Everyone's got, like, hooves. Like, massive hooves. So, like, at the time, we didn't give a fuck, but now it's like, wait a minute, what?
Like, you compare him to Noctis, and by the way, I love the tradition of Final Fantasy naming. It's just ridiculous.
Right, what do you mean?
Noctis.
they generally,
Gladio.
Okay.
Cloud. Sephiroth, which sounds incredibly like serpent and Satan.
Yeah, they're cool names, man. They're cool names.
Yeah.
Cool names. What are you talking about? That's another podcast. But yeah, so, I mean, I don't agree that it's the best ever, and I don't agree with the remake, and now there's people talking, oh, they're going to remake 8 and 9, and it's like, fuck off. Like, man, stop. No, don't remake that shit. Like, part of what... One word that always comes up when people talk about Final Fantasy 7, 8, and 9, specifically, not... And sometimes 10, but more often than not, 7, 8, 9. One word that comes up time and time again is charming. And it's a really interesting word because it's not something you would associate with an action game or something that's kind of, you know, Final Fantasy 7 and 8 have, like we said, very murky protagonists, very kind of dark outlooks on life, and everything is kind of, you know, the end of the world,
mm-hmm.
shit. But I mean, it is super charming. Like, the moments of respite and the characters and some of the, like, the music and the locations and stuff. And like I said about
endearing and not like twee.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you kind of, you want to be a part of it. You want to be in that world. I remember, man, Final Fantasy IX hooked me like no other game I've ever played in my life. I wanted to know every single secret that world had to offer. Mm. I wanted to explore every corner of it. And it wasn't because the world was huge. That's a mistake they made later. They kept mistaking mistaking width for depth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It was like, we have to make this world bigger.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just...
It's not just about size. Like, I mean, you could have the biggest, most expansive locations in the world in gaming history, but there's nothing interesting there.
Skyrim.
Like, and I would say Final Fantasy XII, personally. I know a lot of people disagree, but Final Fantasy XII, I did not care about anything that was going on in that game. I did not care at all. The characters were so boring, and the fucking world was so empty and sparse. I just didn't get it. Anyway, but like seven does that really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does it really well. Like we said in the first part, the town is a character, Midgar is a character. Everything is very, very expressive. There's lots of stuff for you to pay attention to and lots of stuff for you to learn. And, you know, there's always something that you learn. Like, every time I've replayed 7 about 6 times. And every time I've played it, I've noticed something that I didn't notice the last time. So, you know, there's a lot of love that went into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really see that. And when you read about the development process, you can, you know, you find out, oh shit, I was right. There was a lot of love that went into that game. Like, it was a big deal for these people. So yeah, I mean, that's why it resonates even now. As for the remake, I mean, we have to wait and see.
And wait and see we shall. Mm. I think we'll call it there. Thank you very much, Andy, for trying to explain to me why Final Fantasy VII is so important.
Did I succeed?
Mostly.
Mostly?
Like, I mean, And as is going to become more and more apparent as we go through this series, I'm not a fan of JRPGs. So, like, I mean, it was always going to be an uphill struggle. You've convinced me that it does have some redeeming value.
Okay, good. Okay.
So, I've gone from, it was just a game that people have tinted glasses about to, alright, so there's something of value here.
Okay, good. I'll take that as a win for me. Yeah, I'll take that as a win. Okay, so we're going to wrap that up for this week. Thanks for listening, and be sure to check in next time when we're going to talk about one of Ben's favorite games. Ben, what are we talking about next week?
Next week, we continue the eternal war between Japanese and Western RPGs with one of my favorite games, BioWare's singular... title.
Oh yeah, yeah, only the first one, right? Yeah,
well,
yeah.
we can do all three. The start of their space opera, Mass Effect.
And I can guarantee you, I know less about Mass Effect than Ben knew about Final Fantasy VII going into this one, so this is going to be interesting. You can follow us on Twitter at WAIM Podcast. That's WAIM for What Am I Missing? WAIM Podcast on Twitter. You're either listening on SoundCloud or Podbay or YouTube, whichever one you're listening on, but we're on all of them, so, you know, you can find us anywhere. We're going to be invading your ears.
View and listen to them on all of them, actually. Yeah, that would be great.
That would be really cool. Yeah, just, you know, listen on your phone, then when you go home, stick on YouTube and listen to us again.
You don't even actually have to listen, just leave it on mute.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, just play it and turn it off. That really helps us out. Thanks a lot. Okay, so we're gonna leave it there. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.